we would have to go back almost 100 years and look at, you know, each year to see what was the driver of it. It could be coincidence, could be hope. Who knows what it could be? But if you work on those numbers, then the sell in May and go away adage for this year actually, you know, would go the opposite direction.
Hello, welcome to Strictly Money, where your finance and prosperity meet. I'm Sejal Patel. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Strictly Money, where finance and your prosperity meet. I'm Sejal Patel. Today, we are talking about the stock market and the economy, both in Canada as well as the US. Now, the S&P 500 has seen stellar gains. And if you believe that theory that says it's May, which means you sell and go away, you might be tempted to take some profits off the table. Should you? Well, to give us his take and to answer the question that I think most of us want to know, and that is, when are we going to see a rate cut, is Philip Peterson. You may know him because he's come on my show many times. Philip is the chief investment strategist at IG Wealth Management, and he joins me now. Hi, Philip. Thanks for coming on Strictly Money.
Yeah, my pleasure, Sejal. Thank you for having me on.
Let's talk about the S&P 500 and start there, Philip, because we've seen fantastic gains. We are in May, and you know the saying, sell in May, go away. Because there is this theory that the market's going to underperform typically between, you know, May and then October. Should investors go away? What are your thoughts right now? And how are you feeling about the markets?
Yeah, great question. So first, let's tackle the sell in May phrase or you know, kind of rhythm that we tend to see every year. When you actually look at the data, the idea around it is that the markets perform strongly between November and April, and then, yes, perform, you know, more modestly between May and October. The truth is, markets are still up on average between May and October, just not as much as November and April. And we've done all sorts of studies saying, well, what happens if you sell May 1st, come back October 31st? Are you ahead? And really, it doesn't suggest any advantage to doing that. But you know, I think it goes along with the dog days of summer, just the slowdown of summer, and people become perhaps less interested in market movements. And they go, well, maybe it's better if I just sit on the sidelines. Now, what's really interesting is that we're in an election year in the United States. So we actually just did the work. And what we tend to see is the returns in the summer months in an election year tend to be quite strong. So it's almost the opposite of what we think. We think that well, it's a good question. I mean, we would have to go back almost 100 years and look at, you know, each year to see what was the driver of it. It could be coincidence, could be hope. Who knows what it could be? But if you work on those numbers, then the sell in May and go away adage for this year actually, you know, would go the opposite direction.
I think it's going to be interesting, especially because it is going to be an election in the U.S. And I'm not, I don't know about you, but I'm not seeing sort of investor enthusiasm because most people are kind of undecided. They don't feel like either candidate is a great candidate.
Well, that's it. And I think that goes hand in hand with the other question, how do I feel about the S&P 500? Many people immediately, when they start to think about the election, they say, oh, well, it must have a negative impact on the market or a positive impact on the market, whatever it might be. But I'm hearing the same thing. There's a lot of apathy towards either candidate, that neither one is the ideal situation or the ideal choice. And yet the market chugs on for reasons that are really driven by other factors other than the election. The election really has very little to do with performance in the markets. What matters is that the U.S. economy is doing well. Profits are increasing on a year-over-year basis and projected to continue to increase. So companies are performing. When companies perform, guess what? Their stock market performs with it.
Mm-hmm. I definitely want to get into sector picks and what's happening with specific companies, Philip. But I do want to talk about this one because I feel like the big overhang is really about what's going to happen with rates. That's what seems to be dominating, I feel, you know, market sentiment. And no one seems to have a clear window as to when the rates are coming in the U.S. or in Canada. Maybe we can look at the U.S. first. What do you think the Fed chair, Jerome Powell's thinking? What sort of data do you think he's looking at right now?
Right. Well, obviously, he's looking at the inflation data and he's looking at the unemployment data. And then he'll be aware of all the other economic data and factors that drive the U.S. economy. Now, we actually get pretty decent insight into what he's thinking out of the press conferences. And that happened just not too long ago, where he said, you know, we're not thinking about raising rates. It seems that the increases are done. And that seems, you know, I think a little bit more of a foregone conclusion, but it's nice to hear him say that, and that the next move will be a cut. The tricky thing is there is some uncertainty around when this cut is going to happen, because in an election year, the Fed likes to remain on the sidelines, and they don't want to be seen as influencing the election in one way or another. And so if they're going to cut, it's going to be sooner, meaning June or midsummer, or after the election itself. So there's a short window of opportunity here. Either they cut, or it's like go, no go. We're either going to do it now, or we're going to have to wait until after the election. And that in itself creates some of the uncertainty that people are saying, okay, we know the Fed's going to cut, but when?
So if they do cut in June, does that mean that they would probably pause then until after November?
Well, there they can continue, right? Once they set that kind of wheel in motion, they can cut in June, they can cut in September again, and then they can come back in December and cut once more. Or, you know, I think the next meeting coincides right around the election itself, November 7th, and I think the election is the following Tuesday. So they could do that if they say, we're going to start to cut now and we're going to progress along this path. But that's not the general view. The general view is that if the Fed's going to cut, they're probably only going to cut twice this year. And my view is that it might only be once, and that follows the election.
Oh, interesting. Well, you know, when you look at the data, and you talked about inflation and employment, both are still strong. I mean, we're certainly not seeing inflation levels like we did last year. But I thought what was interesting is when you look at the employment cost index. So this, you know, measures worker salaries. It's ticked up. And then when you look at civilian workers, I have this data here, it increased 4.2%. It's even higher if it's tied to unions. And I'm wondering what sort of role that plays.
Well, we know that wages are a significant component to inflation. And we also know, though, that the challenge with the labor market is it's fairly tight. Unemployment is still 3.9% in the United States. That is historically a very low level. We're not seeing claims really tick up in any meaningful way. So if people are being laid off, they're finding another job fairly quickly. And so it does put the Fed in this tricky situation where we see it in our modeling as well, that inflation is not likely to get to their 2% target anytime soon over the course of we model out 9 months. But if I had to speculate, I think it would be deep into 2025 before we see inflation at that level, even if it gets there at all. It could be that inflation ticks a little bit higher on the labor market data or the wages data, as well as what's happening in the commodity complex too. So we're not seeing a lot of disinflationary forces. We're seeing inflation kind of stuck in this 3.5% range, give or take 0.5%.
Okay. Philip, it's a slightly different story here in Canada, though, isn't it? I mean, you're seeing a lot of headlines and a lot of talk around the lack of productivity, that Canada is lagging. Now, we've always kind of had a bit of an issue there, at least for a number of years, but it seems to be exacerbated over the pandemic. But if you have lagging productivity, it means that it puts pressure on wages the other way. Like, it's, you know, you're not seeing that stickiness. I'm wondering if you are seeing that.
Well, I think it goes in line with the broader challenges that the Canadian economy is facing, is that we just really haven't seen much in the way of growth over the last 9 or 10 months. And the productivity challenge, part of that comes from the fact that construction still is a major part of our GDP and certainly a significant part of GDP growth. And with construction, I still need one guy, one hammer, one nail. You know, how do you gain productivity with respect to that? And that's the challenge. We need to look at technology. We need to look at energy. We need to look at other industries if we really want to enhance our productivity in Canada. We can't just be reliant on construction. That then, though, begs the question of, okay, we do have lower inflation, meaningfully lower inflation in Canada than the United States, weaker economic growth. Bank of Canada is in a much different situation.
Yeah. And so do you think that they're going to cut rates soon?
Yeah, I actually was of the mind that they had the window open to cut rates in April. They chose not to. I think that was a mistake. I think now June is solidly on the table, but we could see June, then July, and then and then further cuts as the year goes on.
So what do you think Chip Macklem's waiting for then?
Well, I think he does have to be aware that the unintended consequence of interest rate cuts is a weaker Canadian dollar.
We've seen and that. It is weaker.
It is weaker today. It's below 73 cents. And our view is that if the Fed cuts once more than expected if the Bank of Canada cuts once more than expected than the Fed, that could drive our dollar sub 72 cents closer to 70 cents US. And so that there are some consequences to that, some positive, some negative, some inflationary when you think about that. So it kind of, he's fighting against himself in a way, but ultimately the path is lower interest rates in Canada. It's just a necessity given the much weaker growth we have
here. Yeah, it just goes to show how closely tied we are to the US. You know, we can't make these policy decisions in a vacuum. When we talk about the US or Canadian versus US dollar, though, on one hand, wouldn't it actually help our exporters? I mean, we are a resource-based economy. I would think it would help the economy, commodity complex, rather.
Absolutely, and it does there. So any producers, especially when you're thinking about energy, when you're thinking about metals and mining, they produce in Canadian dollars but sell in U.S. dollars. So from the stock market perspective, a weaker Canadian dollar really provides a nice boost to the energy sector, material sector. For the other areas of the Canadian economy, anyone that is looking to upgrade machinery, for example, a lot of that machinery comes out of the United States, priced in US dollars. That stuff just got more expensive.
Okay. Well, I certainly don't like it when I like traveling. So, I was just in New York a couple of weeks ago, Philip, and you feel it. When you look at your credit card statement, you're like, oh, wow. but again, good for exporters. Phil, we're going to take a quick commercial break and hear from our sponsors, BMO ETFs, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm here with Philip Peterson of IG Wealth Management. Philip, before we move on to your sector picks and, you know, how you're feeling about the TSX versus the S&P 500. Do you think investors are paying too much attention to the fact that, you know, we are going to see a rate cut, although we don't know when, and do they have to?
Great question. At this point, I think expectations for rate cuts, both in Canada and the United States, is already priced into the market. I think if we look back over the past 6 months, that was the, you know, with respect to Jerome Powell and the Federal Reserve, will he or won't he? What's the path? What are we doing? Now we have clarity. We have clarity that the next move is going to be a cut. Market is saying and comfortable with, okay, two cuts is more likely this year, and then we'll get into 2025 as we approach it. But I don't think it's going to influence the market in one way or another at this point, unless it was a surprise pivot to interest rate increases again. But that doesn't seem to be an option at this point.
Okay. So the TSX lagging the S&P 500, presumably because our economic growth is a bit softer. When I look at the valuations, it seems like the TSX, if I'm correct, it's trading around 14 times PE, S&P is around 20 times. I want to get your thoughts on the TSX then. Are the cheaper valuations meaning that it's a good time to get in?
Another great question. And we've struggled with this through the year. Our current positioning is underweight Canada in our asset allocation portfolios.
Still.
And overweight to emerging markets. So it's been a nice cross trade for us. Emerging markets have outperformed Canada and it's added value. The interesting thing about it, though, is that it's not that we dislike Canada. We actually think Canada can deliver a positive return, or the TSX can deliver a positive return in 2024, an attractive one. It's just that when we compare it to valuation elsewhere and the earnings potential elsewhere, it just looks a little bit more attractive. The tricky thing about the TSX is that we know when oil does well, the TSX does well. And so now I have to have a view on oil, and that's the challenge. So the range of outcomes for the TSX versus other markets over the course of the next 12 months is much wider. Oil gets above $90 a barrel, we should see the TSX outperform. But am I comfortable making that bet? Not at this point.
What about financials then, Phil? Because financials make up a big part of the TSX. And if we do see a rate cut, that's usually good news for banks and insurance companies.
Yes. And so we think that financials are actually in a decent place. They're attractively valued in Canada when we look at the banks or the insurance companies. They continue to deliver decent results and are paying a very, very strong dividend. So we think, again, you know, it's not that we dislike Canada, it's that we like other areas, but there are areas in Canada that we think will do well. The cyclicals, meaning energy and materials, I think the financials do well, I think industrials do well. You know, the areas that could surprise to the upside as well, if we see aggressive rate cuts out of the Bank of Canada, could be utilities and consumer staples. So, you know, there are pockets of opportunity. You pick your spots, I think you'll do well. But you can't just look at Canada in a vacuum. You have to look at, okay, but what are the other options out there? And, you know, there are some that look a little bit more attractive.
You mentioned emerging markets. So what do you like?
Well, I look at the emerging markets as a whole. Now, if you look at the emerging markets, you do have to be somewhat Asian-centric, given that it's about 70% of the emerging market index. But there we're seeing good news. The macro indicators that we look to for health of the Chinese economy are pointing up.
Are they? Okay.
Yeah, they are. So, and we think this is in part why copper prices have rebounded and hitting the levels that they have been, is because manufacturing is getting going again in China. And China, after a couple of years, is finally righting the ship. At least that's what it seems as far as the data is concerned, that growth is picking up, and this is positive for Asian equity markets overall.
Do you have a view on India, Philip? Because, again, we're in the midst of an election there.
We are. I don't have a big view on it. And the reason why is it is a small part of the index. I wouldn't make an allocation to India directly. I would do it as emerging markets overall. So at this point in time, it's not a significant area of focus for us.
Okay, so the U.S., let's talk about the U.S. We've talked about this many times, Philip. It's been really dominated by the Magnificent Seven. Although, I don't know about you, but I have been hearing that the money is spreading out now to other sectors. So I want to get your thoughts on that and what you're seeing, and whether it's a value play or a growth play there.
Another great question. Yeah. So first, let's start with the Magnificent Seven, because I've heard recently, as we follow it, you know, maybe we're down to the final four. As you know, Tesla hasn't performed quite as well as people had expected, and we've seen some of the others. You know, Meta wobbled a little bit, you know, with their most recent results, but you're right in terms of we've seen more breadth in the marketplace, and this is very healthy for the S&P 500. When we look at the first quarter as the example, the contribution to performance came from across the board, across the valuation spectrum, from the cheapest 100 companies to the most expensive 100 companies. The average and median return was somewhere between 7% and 8%. And so it wasn't driven by any one particular stock or any one sector. It was fairly broadly represented. And that makes for a good market. So is it a growth market or is it a value market? I think it's more quality, to be honest with you. I think what we've been seeing is that companies that are delivering quality are doing well. And it's not, quality doesn't mean you have to outperform expectations, because a lot of companies that have beaten aren't necessarily rewarded, but companies that are steady and delivering, you know, consistent results have seen their shares rise.
The AI story is you know, dominating again headlines too. And I always point out, you know, there's the AI story and there's a tech story. Although a lot of the tech plays are starting to integrate AI. What's your view on that? And what do you think it means for profitability and risk?
Well, I think there will definitely be winners and losers here. The interesting thing is we're seeing, as far as CEO speak goes during the conference calls, two phrases that have popped up more than anything else in the last quarter has been AI and then machine learning. So it's the latest corporate buzzword. Everyone is jumping on the bandwagon, but there'll be the real winners and then there'll be the pretenders. And I think it comes down to, AI isn't just limited to technology companies. While many tech companies are involved in it, it's other companies. How are insurance companies going to incorporate it into their normal day-to-day business processes? And we don't know. Ultimately, we don't know at this point, but those companies that will be able to utilize it and then monetize it will be the ones that will win. If I had to speculate, you know, early winners look to me to be you know, companies like Microsoft or Salesforce that already have deep entrenched relationships on the corporate side. And if they incorporate AI applications, take Microsoft, for example, into Office 365, that makes me more productive. Well, they can monetize that and they can win.
Are you seeing the AI story dominate here in Canada?
No, not necessarily. Again, you know, Canada is, the TSX is driven by really three broad sectors, you know, technology, or sorry, not technology, it's financials, it's materials, and it's energy. Now, you know, will these sectors be able to utilize different aspects of AI to gain productivity? I think so. But are there any clear winners today? Not yet.
Okay. Philip, are you seeing a lot of money on the sidelines? And the reason I ask this is because so much money was parked in GICs with interest rates higher. And I have to think as rates start dropping, we might start seeing that rotation back into stocks. And I'm wondering if you have a view on that and maybe, you know, what that means for valuations.
Yeah, we have seen that. We've seen over the past couple of years, really since 2022, a significant amount of money has gone into GICs or parked in money market funds. And it really hasn't come out yet. I was looking at the money market assets in the United States just the other day, and you know, we're still near the all-time high, which means people are very comfortable just leaving it there. There's a risk to that. The risk isn't just necessarily that interest rates will start to come down, so cash will be a diminishing asset or a diminishing return as far as an asset class goes, but it's the missed opportunity. So it's the opportunity cost of not being in equities. Now, if you're allocating, say, from fixed income to cash, and the yield is the same, no difference to your portfolio. But some investors that perhaps were spooked by the market in 2022 parked in cash and haven't come back, well, they've missed out on significant gains that they might not get another opportunity for.
Yeah, because we know the market's priced, what, at least 6 months, if not 9 months ahead of the economy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Philip, are there any themes that you're watching for in 2024 that excite you, worry you?
Well, I would say in general, from 2023 to 2024, we're more optimistic on the global economy. We've seen a solid pivot towards improvement, whether it's global exports, global manufacturing, and this leads to a better economic path going forward. Now, so that begs the question, is it a no landing? Is it a hard landing? Is it a soft landing? You know, I think maybe we could put that all aside and say it's business as usual. Companies are generating profits and they're being rewarded for it, and consumers in the United States and other areas around the world are in healthy positions, and so they continue to spend. And so, yeah, I remain optimistic. Yeah, I think the first quarter was very positive, very strong, but I don't think when we think about the year, people say, well, has the year been front-end loaded, meaning all the gains are coming in the first quarter? I'd say no, because I think we can continue to see companies generate profit gains on a year-over-year basis in Q2, Q3, and Q4. So I'm optimistic where the market's going forward. I think we need to stay the course and stay reasonable in terms of our financial goals and assumptions.
Yeah. I found what's interesting is I just remember the days where, you know, geopolitical risk would be, people would react quite strongly. We're not seeing that as much anymore.
No, we haven't. And we can go back over the last, call it 6 or so months with the Hamas attack in Israel, and the market really didn't respond one way or another to it. And that's been the case as we've gone on. So maybe we're learning that geopolitical risk doesn't really have a lasting or meaningful impact on the markets, as our view on it. Or investors are just focused on the good news right now, and the bad news doesn't really weigh on their sentiment as much as it perhaps it did, say, you know, 10 or 20 years ago.
Okay. Philip, I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure being here again.
Yeah, thanks so much. Now, you know that I asked 3 rapid fire questions because I did this with you last time. So I'm not going to ask you the same questions. I want to ask you different questions this time. What do you think, and I'm asking you this because you are the chief investment strategist for IG, but you obviously have your own personal finance and decisions that you make personally. What is the best financial decision that you've made?
Oh, I would say, you know, probably the easiest one is working with an advisor, because there's so many things that we don't know. And I can build a portfolio, I think, better than or as good as anyone else out there, if not better. But what I don't know about is taxation, insurance, and how all that works together with respect to building an overall comprehensive financial plan.
That's a good one. And you know what? At the same time, too, I feel like there's a stigma behind asking for help or delegating these things, but we're all busy, you know, even if you did know how to do it. And I know how to do a lot of it, but I rely on other people.
Well, I often say, you know, it's you can try and do it yourself, but who's going to answer the questions if you're not here? God forbid something happens to me. You know, I want to know that my family is well taken care of through our planet.
Yeah. And my last question, I'm only going to ask you two. How do you personally manage risk? How do you think about it?
To be honest with you, the way I approach it is with a long-term view. That's ultimately, I mean, you know, if you have short-term goals, then you have to manage the risk, you know, so you don't want to meet shortfall over the course of the next year or 2 years. For example, kids going into university, it's like, well, that, you know, that's a funding issue in the immediate 2 year timeframe. But otherwise, if I'm thinking about longer term goals, then I just take comfort in the fact that, look, I know markets will be volatile day to day. Not to say just be completely oblivious to the conditions around you, but take that volatility in stride, knowing that my long-term goal.
Are you looking to enhance the level of cash flow from your investments? BMO ETFs has you covered with their coverage call ETFs. These ETFs generate cash flow from two sources, the dividend yield from the underlying securities and the premium generated from selling the call options. BMO covered call ETFs strike a balance between generating cash flow and participating in the growth of rising markets with their experienced portfolio management team and effective strategy with over 10 years of history. BMO ETFs is the largest covered call ETF provider in Canada, covering 13 covered call ETFs across a range of strategies across regions, countries, and sectors. Visit BMOETFs.com to learn more. Please read the ETF facts or prospectus of the BMO ETFs before investing.
Comes with long-term gains.
That's a good one and a great way to end the podcast. Thank you so much. And for those of you who are interested in hearing more about what Philip has to say and his commentary around markets and the economy, I really urge you to subscribe to The Living Market. That's his podcast. Phil, where can people subscribe to that?
You can find it. And thank you for that, Sage. I really appreciate the shout out on that. You can find it on iTunes. You can find it on Spotify. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it anywhere that you access your podcast.
Just like this, but we will make sure we put it in the show notes so people can subscribe.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thanks again, Phil. Well, that does it for this episode of Strictly Money. Don't forget to subscribe to YouTube if you want to watch the podcast. If you're listening, you can find me on Apple or Spotify or wherever you find your podcasts. We'll see you back here next week. And until then, stay well, stay wise, and stay wealthy.